Here in Australia, we take for granted the fact that our electoral process is free and fair, or at least we did until the last election. But the same can't be said for polls everywhere. In some countries, elections are marred by violence, intimidation, fraud, or plain old incompetence. So how do you measure whether or not an election is free and fair, and who does that? Well, her name is Pippa Morris. She runs the internationally recognised Electoral Integrity Project, which assesses all the elections held around the world. And I spoke to her earlier.
Thank you very much, James.
Why is it important to grade elections, given all of us know that Germany and Norway will be near the top and Equatorial Guinea and so forth will be near the bottom?
Well, one reason is that elections have spread around the world in the last decade. So it used to be that it was basically in Western democracies, and of course places like Norway, Germany and Australia always would come out and assumed to be okay. Nowadays, of course, what's happened is that many countries which are run by autocracies, with dictators at the top, or with one-party states, also have elections. So the quality of the election is really important. A second reason is that, of course, even in established democracies, elections have become more controversial, the procedures, the electoral authorities. So we really need some good evidence when people claim that elections have gone wrong, and sore losers often do, whether or not it's true.
What do you mean when you say autocracies are having elections?
Oh, there are many examples. There's only about 5 countries worldwide that don't now have elections for the legislature.
Countries on earth don't have legislative elections?
That's right. And you can kind of name them. It's mostly the Gulf states and absolute monarchies, one-party states and so on. So nearly everywhere else has now got nominally multi-party elections, even places like Belarus and Tajikistan. The problem, of course, is that they're not open, they're not free, they're not competitive, and the ruling party often wins by a variety of different techniques.
And when we think of those techniques, the classic is the stuffing of the ballot box, the rigging of the count. Is that the core of the problem?
Well, again, that comes to mind, and that's often in the headlines in the media. But the problems are actually much earlier than that. There's a complete electoral cycle. It goes right back to the electoral law. Is that going to be fair to all parties? How you draw the district boundaries? And you've got countries like Singapore that run very honest elections at the ballot box. But because it's gerrymandering or malapportionment in how they draw their districts, the ruling party continues to win. Or it could be problems of, for example, campaign funding. Who gets the money or the resources for that? Or the way in which the media, how do you get access? So problems can occur at all those different stages.
And on this spectrum, which countries are improving and which countries are not?
What we can say is that established democracies like Norway often do well. Number one, Norway. Germany, number two, the Netherlands. Not a surprise. But look at some new democracies. We find countries like the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Lithuania doing really well in the top 10.
Which is remarkable for former communist countries within living memory to be in the top 10 on earth.
Top 10 of all those countries which have had elections in the last 18 months.
I see.
So that's basically 73 elections that we rank.
How can political cultures be transformed in such a relatively short period of time?
Well, I think these countries often had basically an effective public administration. So they can kind of know how to run an election. The civil service is well trained, they're professional, they've got resources, and particularly they've become committed to issues of human rights in a fairly short time.
And so also they were kind of well-run-ish countries with coherent structures, and they had everything except elections under
the
communists.
Right. That's right. And of course, don't forget, before the Second World War, they also had sometimes multi-party countries as well before they were taken over as part of the Soviet Union. But there are a lot of other countries, even some established democracies, that don't come out as well. And this does, of course, include the United States coming out 26th. Which is really remarkable out of our 73 elections. And then at the bottom, again, we've got some interesting cases. So yes, we do find some countries with a very weak state, fragile state, like Equatorial Guinea, Djibouti, the Congo. These are countries which often have real problems of human rights, one-party dictators, and lack of capacity. So things can go wrong, even simple things like the ballot boxes. They run out of ballot places, they don't have the right security. There's a protest and then the security forces don't know how to handle it.
There needn't be malice involved.
There needn't. It's sometimes incompetence, a lack of governance as much as lack of democracy. But often those two things can go together. And think about running an election. Think about India. It's just about to happen. The Lok Sabha is having an election. 800 million people in a country with lots of illiterates, with very rural areas. Now, India does know how to do it effectively and has run so many elections very well ever since they got independence. But things can still go wrong. And even in India, for example, with a very professional election management body, almost 1 million poll workers, can you imagine that? an election that's staggered so that not everybody goes to the polling station on the same day, because if they did, India would grind to a halt.
The world would tilt.
Precisely. You go to the polling station in India, every voter has a voter ID with a photo on it, so they know how to do it, but even there they get, for example, always some violence. Some people can be killed in some polling stations because of communal tensions. So you can have a democracy with elections that still go wrong because it's a complex organisation. Or you can have a country where there isn't the will. Malaysia, again, an election very recently that's highly controversial, came very close. So the opposition really thought they had a chance. The trouble is malapportionment in how they've drawn their boundaries, and the electoral law means the opposition has a really tough time. Cambodia is another example, and of course Thailand. You've been covering that, I'm sure.
Does a fiercely disputed election necessarily mean an unfair election?
No, again, you can often have a history which has created bitter disputes. And so a case like Nigeria is one that comes to mind, which the last election, with Goodluck Jonathan winning, the international observers said was pretty good in terms of the actual function, how it was run, how many people were able to vote. But there was immediately violence, and particularly between the north and the south. The north, which is predominantly Muslim, thought that it was their turn to have the presidency. The south said, hey, we'd run a good election. And so there was violence and property was damaged and there was disputes immediately afterwards. But international observers said it was pretty fair by Nigerian standards. And so having an election is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it can be really dangerous because it can spark conflagration. On the other hand, nowadays, you have to have an election in many ways because nobody is now accepting that you can have an appointed authority or that you can have any other mechanism to get legitimately into power.
So do you, as a Democrat, say a fair and transparent and open election is always inherently good?
Yes.
Even if it can lead to conflict, the outcome?
Even if it can lead to conflict, because basically now the international community can't do anything else. And of course, think about cases like Afghanistan, think about cases like Iraq, even more confrontation, right? And in Afghanistan in 2004, when there was a new constitution, you could say, well, should we have waited? Should the international community basically first build the state, build security, rule of law, try to stamp out some corruption? Or should they try and have an election with all sorts of problems, because the parties weren't organised, the warlords were in charge of certain provinces, there was threats, violence against women, for example. And in the end, the international community says you have to go through the electoral route. The 2004 election was pretty good. By 2008, it went wrong again. The international community wasn't putting in so many resources, and corruption was so high. And again, with Afghanistan, we're going to have another presidential election. It's going to be very contentious. But in a sense, what else can you do? You can have a military coup, you can have a suspension, you can have an appointed authority, but all of those are unsatisfactory and those are going to lead to conflict as well. So what you're trying to do, James, is really have the best type of electoral system which is going to mitigate conflict, and that is often one which has proportional representation so that many parties are represented. You might try and build into the law the inclusion of minorities. So you make sure that women are included through quotas. That's increasingly common, as it was in Afghanistan and Iraq. And you make sure that minority communities, as in Lebanon, are represented to their districts. So if you have small groups who are otherwise threatened, for example, the Kurds in Iraq, you try and make sure that there's systems whereby they can get some voice in the system and are included. But nowadays, with human rights as our basic mandate, every country has signed on to that. Every country has signed on to elections, basically, nowadays, except for about five countries. And even those, by the way, are moving towards elections.
What ones are they?
Well, for example, Bahrain and Qatar keeps on talking about elections, hasn't yet happened. North Korea just had its elections, one-party elections.
But what's the point of even discussing that as an election?
Well, it's interesting. I went to Hanoi recently, just a month ago, and spoke to them. And it's a one-party state. They have elections. And so they talked about how they could get more competition, for example, amongst their candidates. So even if you only have one party, are there ways in which you get different candidates and primaries? Now, that's not as satisfactory. You still do want to have more parties.
But it's a healthy endeavour because it can form of what, a cultural foundation, a political
Precisely.
Culture for the future?
That's right. And also you get the experience of elections. You polls are actually, turnout is quite high in Vietnam. And so people get to practice elections, if you like. And then if you get an opening, which you often do, then you get more parties, and then you can get a more level playing field, but it's a gradual process.
Wonderful way of describing it, practicing elections.
Yeah, yeah. And think about Australia. I mean, elections are a habit that you grow up with, and so you vote when you're young, and you kind of learn it as you go through. And countries have to learn democracy.
And yet, because we've had that since, well, before Federation, we had elections, right, even into the 19th century. It's so much a part of us. And the Australian Electoral Commission is such a, what I would have thought would have been a revered institution.
Absolutely.
And we thought that it was second to none, and the world looked to us as this great country. Just in the last 12 months, we've had this called into doubt by Clive Palmer, who says Australian elections are rigged, the Australian Electoral Commission misplacing ballot papers, which is required for the first time in history, a by-election for a Senate in an entire state.
Mm-hmm.
What are your observations of this?
Increasingly, even established democracies, all the rules of the game are coming up and people are becoming much more partisan in how they see this. And another example, Canada. Canada, I mean, it's like Norway for Sweden for me. It's always up there for human rights. It's one of the leading world countries, just like Australia. And again, right now, the Parliament is debating the Fair Elections Act, which the Conservative government has brought in, which is going to reduce voting facilities, for example, for students.
Let me guess, the rationale for the change is to prevent fraud.
Absolutely. And of course, where have they learnt this from? From the Republicans south of the border, bringing in new laws to try and restrict and make sure that there's only photo ID, voter identification.
And in Australia, you don't even need identification, and right, you can turn up, and there aren't computers. And we've thought till now that this has been our strength, but this has been called into question by Clive Palmer and others who say it's a weakness.
Yes. And so lots of countries...
Well, which is it, if you don't mind?
Well, lots of countries want to bring in, for example, new technology. So it's natural. But the new technology brings in security questions. Lots of countries are going through exactly the same issues. Now, losing ballot boxes isn't good by any standards and any stretch of the imagination. But again, in Australia, I still think that elections are done incredibly well. And indeed, our experts say much the same.
Where are we on the list?
You're about 15, so that's great. You're up there with all the other established countries, Japan and Chile and Cyprus and Israel and so on, around the same level. So most experts thought your last federal election was good. And I think that's absolutely right.
Important work. Thank you for it, Professor Pippa Norris.
Thank you, James.
And Professor Pippa Norris is the director of the Electoral Integrity Project, a multi-million dollar research effort that is partly made possible, I should say, by the Australian Research Council funding. Pippa is also professor at both Harvard University and Sydney University, former director of governance for the UN. And also, I should mention, New South Wales voters could be casting their ballots online at next year's state election without leaving home, because a joint parliamentary inquiry yesterday recommended online voting be allowed for all those who wish to make use of it. Of course, the government will have to respond. We'll see what happens in time.